September in Maine News, the month in review. Can you believe it's almost October? After what seemed like an endless summer, suddenly the leaves are changing, the acorns are falling, and the political debates have begun. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we pause to reflect on the month of September and the headlines that made news. We've seen resurgences of COVID-19 in York and Oxford counties after a wedding that seems to be a super spreader event. Maine's U.S. Senate race is in the spotlight as Democrats aim to retake the Senate. Polls show a razor-tight race. Schools reopened, and then some closed, as some fall sports go on and others don't. What news mattered most to you this month? We'll check in with our regular panel of editorial page editors and journalists from regional papers. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Believe it or not, it is the last day of the month, so we are gathered to put the news of September into perspective. On the line with us, Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News, Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and Greg Kesich, editorial page editor, Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. And a little later in the program, we're going to check in with even more journalists from around the state. As always, we want to hear from you. Which stories in September stood out to you and why? Feel free to join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to our Facebook page. And don't forget that Maine Calling is moving to a new time, 11 a.m., starting next week. The same programming, just a little earlier in the day. Susan, Ben, Greg, welcome back.
Hey.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yes, of course. You know, just because September didn't have enough news, we started today with, 100,000 power outages. But and I am in the studio instead of at home because of that. I want to start, though, by ripping off the Band-Aid. We are, in this program, going to focus on Maine news. But there was the first presidential debate last night, and so we will address that briefly and then move on. Susan Young, did you watch the debate, and what's your reaction?
I did watch the debate, and I can't quote Dana Bash because we're not allowed to say those things on the air, but her assessment of how bad the debate was, I think, was spot on. It was just a mess from the content to the behavior, particularly of the president constantly interrupting, and unfortunately, Chris Wallace tried but couldn't maintain control. So don't think it was at all helpful for voters, the small group that may still need to get some more information about these candidates. It was just a complete disaster.
Oh, my goodness. Greg Kesich, your assessment?
Yeah. You know, I spent a lot of time in the 80s and 90s paying attention to politics, and last night I felt like I really should have been focused more on professional wrestling, because I think I would have understood better what was going on. You know, the whole ideas of how you win in these hype fests and who gets to talk and, you know, what's important really comes out of that arena more than any kind of discourse. And you have to really question now, like, is the whole debate idea broken? You know, what do we really get out of these things? What do voters learn? We don't really see any kind of exchange of ideas in the best of times. You know, we just see these sort of pre-programmed responses to very predictable questions. And, you know, maybe we would be better off if all the candidates got a half an hour airtime to give a speech or some kind of, you know, PowerPoint presentation or something else, you know, something with some depth to it.
Sure. Ben Bragdon.
With live fact checking.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the thing about live fact checking is even live has a delay. So you're bringing up the facts a few moments after they're said, and then something else has been said in the meantime. Yeah. Ben Bragdon.
Yeah, it was horrifying. You know, anyone tuning in to
to seek some clarity on these big issues facing this country. It certainly didn't find it during those 90 minutes. The president, you know, doesn't seem to want to talk about his health care plan, whatever that is. He doesn't want to talk about his response to COVID or what he wants to do in the when he gets reelected in any way. He doesn't seem to have any desire to talk about anything else except for the stuff that motivates his small base, you know, his insults and conspiracy theories that, you know, most of America doesn't even understand, you know, at a time when you think most politicians would be trying to pull more people into their coalition to try to win this election. He's not doing that. He's just trying to sow, you know, chaos and distrust around the electoral process. We've got a little over a month to go before this election, and it really feels like it's, you know, pulling the country apart. And a big part of the problem is, as we saw last night, was the president's doing a lot of the pulling.
Okay, I'm going to regroup, and we're going to talk about Maine news, and we're going to talk about what's really important. And I'm going to start with you, Greg Kesich. I'm going to argue that the resurgence of COVID-19 cases is the big story in Maine. We were doing so well, still doing very well compared to the rest of the nation, but a bit of a reality check.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to put it, reality check. It's I think a lot of people thought they were immune. You know, there was a lot of pressure to socially distance and have mask wearing become common and in some areas, but in other areas, it was just considered to be government overreach or unnecessary, or, you know, people were getting away with it. And now, it's not every time, but people are who flout the rules are found themselves in these outbreaks. We saw it obviously with the wedding in Millinocket, and the way that that spread across the state. York County Jail, where there was mask rules in place that were not being observed, and we're seeing it also in other outbreaks in Oxford County, places like that. So yeah, you're right. It is the big story. It's scary how it's starting to creep back, and it's happening in places that are not really equipped to handle it.
Ben, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Every time we do a Maine calling program that has to do with COVID-19, it seems as though we get a flurry of messages from the Augusta-Waterville area where people are frustrated that people at the big box stores, at the grocery store, not wearing masks. I know that this is not a scientific read on the state of Maine, but I have noticed a trend. Have you noticed that in what you're receiving as editorial page editor, as what you see out and about? Does this seem to be a real point of tension in your part of the state?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a little bit more of a uniformity with it in southern Maine, where there were these smaller outbreaks all over the place, and people had to be careful right from the start, and maybe where there are you know more people with the political leanings that would have you know would have taken care all the way around. And I think as you get further up in Maine, further away from these hot spots, more into an area where people's politics, more of them are going to minimize the pandemic and kind of make fun of mask wearing. You know, I think things drop. I've been through some of the more rural areas of the state in the last couple of months, and I noticed that that compliance was pretty low, although not as low as I thought. But I mean, you know, half and half in a big grocery store, and then not at all in some of the smaller stores, people running into, you know, a convenience store, not wearing a mask. So I think there's probably some more of that tension up there. I think kind of what Greg hinted at there is that some of these places aren't as prepared, you know, for an outbreak, and that we're, you know, just a case away of a person in the right situation getting in the wrong place and at the wrong time, and you could see what happened in York County or what's happening in Androscoggin County or Oxford County happening in some of the other places.
Mm. And Susan, I want to ask you not only about Bangor East and North, but also sort of to wrap in a little bit the tourist season. I know somebody who works in Bar Harbor talking about how August and through Labor Day was really booming. Is that the sense you're getting from all those wonderful tourism hotspots in that part of the state?
I think the overall message is that tourism was better than the dire predictions, but a lot of folks in the industry are still feeling that, you know, it was bleak. Yes, July and August was okay, but the months before were bad, and they're very worried about the fall and what happens going into the holidays. So they're pleased that there was more traffic, but it's not enough to make up for their losses elsewhere, which ties in, and we've talked a lot about the dangers of coronavirus and some people not taking it seriously, but also the economic impacts. And obviously there's controversy over restrictions that the governor put in place and a lot of people blaming those for an economic downturn. But it just highlights the need, you know, as you say, Maine has done well, but to stay vigilant and keep the number of cases as low as possible so that we can have economic activity. Because if it really gets bad again, we have no choice, as other states have done, to shut down parts of the economy again, to have people stay home and try and limit the spread of the disease. So it's really walking a tightrope. But to Ben's point, I've been pleased, at least in the Bangor area, going to the grocery store and seeing everyone wear a mask. And that's very different than the spring. But certainly the farther north you go, it does feel like there are fewer people wearing masks. And it's not just routine, which it seems to be for most people in this area.
Mm. So much more to talk about, including schools reopening and fall sports and the race for U.S. Senate. But first, I want to turn to Sarah Craighead Dedman, who's editor of the Machias Valley News Observer. Sarah, thanks so much for giving us a call.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jennifer.
I want to catch up on some news from your part of Maine and some news that people in the rest of Maine might not have been really following closely. There's a fish farm proposed for Jonesport. Tell us about that fish farm and how close it is to being a reality.
Yeah, it took another big step closer on Monday. Kingfish is the company. They're a Dutch company, and they first came and let their intentions be known to Jonesport last year. And what they received this week was a submerged land lease that will allow them to install some pipes in Chandler Bay. And what this could ultimately mean is a multi-million, maybe $100 million investment in the area with about 70 jobs, which is a tremendous, tremendous amount of jobs for the area. So they're growing, they're going to grow, it's land-based aquaculture, and it's a fish called yellowtail, which I gather is pretty popular in sushi and sashimi, but can be used for lots of other things.
Has this faced the same kind of criticism, the same kind of controversy as the proposed farm in Belfast?
Not at all, really. It seems to be fairly well received. One thing that it might be different is that the owners did come in sort of gently with an approach that was that said, we're not going to force this down your throats if we're not welcome here. And they had several public hearings. They continually have coffee hour at the local store, even in socially distanced time. So I think they've, you know, they seem to have built some positive relationships in Jonesport. This is covered by, we have a stalwart journalist in Jonesport named Nancy Beal, who's been all over this from the beginning. It's been great, but no, it has not encountered opposition. And they did also say in the beginning that they were really, you know, attracted to the Jonesport work ethic, which comes from its strong fishing community.
That's aquaculture. Now I'm going to turn to agriculture. There's also a hemp farm making news in your area.
Yeah, I love this story. So the owners of this farm, they have the Edwards family. It's a 200-year-old family farm. They all have other jobs, but they wanted to kind of create a proof of concept for Washington County farmers that they might be able to follow in the future, that to find a product that could really you know, succeed here and create some more jobs. And so last year they started a hemp farm, and I think they had about 10 acres last year. This year they have 20. And their intention when they started it was to sell the product, this organic hemp, to the wholesale market to make things like CBD oil and treatments like that. But unfortunately, earlier this year, the wholesale market cratered, and the prices dropped between 80 and 90%. And so they just sort of had to pivot and create a retail product of their own, since there was no one to sell this product to. And they've done it. They've got this really chic website. They make these organic hemp and arnica salves, and they make these, they have a French chef they work with to create these, I can't say it in French, but they're basically little jellies that are infused with CBD oil. And it's very chic. And it's in this really beautiful part of Machias, this called the Kennebec District. So you see these long rows of what look like, they really look like Christmas trees, going down to the sea. And they're in their harvest period right now. I'm sorry for them that they've got so much rain right now, because I know that's a factor. But during this year's harvest, they expect to pull in about 70 to 100 seasonal workers. And they chose this product because the harvest season dovetails so beautifully between blueberry season and wreathing season, which are two major seasonal employers here.
All right. There's a new national cemetery in your part of Maine. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we had the dedication ceremony a month ago for Acadia National Cemetery. And this is kind of a big deal. And it was sort of a well-attended, well-heeled event. We had Susan Collins come and the VA Secretary Robert Wilkie. It's only the second national cemetery in Maine. The only other one was closed to interments in 1960s. That's Togus. And there are three state veteran cemeteries, but the National Cemetery Administration tries to have a cemetery within 75 miles of kind of everybody. And so they picked Jonesboro, and the land was given to them by the Worcester family, which they're famous for wreaths across America. In the winter, they take the wreaths from Washington County down to Arlington National Cemetery. So anyway, we had the cemetery dedication, and then now the Worcesters have also erected 1 mile of these posts along Route 1 near the cemetery, where they put up American flags on both sides of the road for a whole mile. It's really quite a scene. It's quite beautiful.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Sarah, I'm so appreciative of you joining us. I know there's even more news there, that you've had some really terrible tragedies in your region, and a local Facebook page dedicated to history has exploded in popularity, but we have to go to a break. So people are just going to have to read the Machias Valley News Observer if they want to learn about those stories. That's Sarah Craighead Dedman, the editor of the Machias Valley News Observer. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from St. Mary's Health System Orthopedics, offering comprehensive orthopedic care in Portland and Auburn. stmarysortho.com. Evergreen Subaru in Auburn, Maine, committed to going the extra mile for its customers, its team, and its community. evergreensubaru.com. And Marshall Communications with Nancy Marshall's The PR Maven podcast, offering advice on building your brand and network. marshallpr.com.
Online learning is a huge challenge anywhere, but especially in rural areas that still don't have high-speed internet.
When COVID hit, we went online. I thought, well, that's great. I'll be able to get my kids' schooling done in a few hours, and then they'll be to work with Dad, and it didn't turn out so great.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Back to school in the rural digital divide this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up later this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Late this summer, we were notified that a few national programs in our schedule were being discontinued, including Live From Here, Only a Game, and the weekday 11 a.m. second hour of On Point. Therefore, starting this coming weekend, we've made some adjustments to the Maine Public Radio schedule to accommodate these cancellations, adjust the schedule slightly, and bring new programs to the airwaves, including As It Happens, Freakonomics, and Snap Judgment. For more information and to see the schedule, please visit mainepublic.org and click on the radio dropdown. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the top news stories in Maine from the month of September. With me today, Greg Kesich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, and Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. We'd love for you to be part of the conversation. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or call us at 1-800-399-3566. Ben Bragdon, we've made it 25 minutes past the hour without talking about the U.S. Senate race. The polls show it very, very close, and there have already been a couple of debates. What do we know now that we didn't know earlier in the summer about this race?
Well, it seems like it's kind of stayed the same throughout. I mean, I think that Senator Collins, who is either tied or trailing in most of the polls, was hoping to get something out of the debates. She was pushing Sarah Gideon, her Democratic opponent, to have 16 debates, one in every county. She obviously thought that that would be a strength for her as the incumbent and longtime senator, and that she could maybe show the race has really been a referendum on Susan Collins, and maybe show that Sarah Gideon wasn't, in her league, but Gideon's performed pretty well at both the debates, and I doubt that they really changed much of anything in the race. I don't think I haven't seen any recent polls, and of course we just had the last debate Monday night, but I don't think there was anything there that really changed the nature of the race.
Susan, how many undecided voters are there really for this Senate race?
It's so hard to know, and it's easy to be skeptical. How can people not know? I mean, the choices are very clear. Of course, this election is going to use ranked choice voting. So if folks are inclined to support the other two candidates in the race, Lisa Savage or Max Lynn, they can do that while also picking someone who they think has a more realistic chance of winning. So, it's as always a choice between two candidates, but just a little more complex with ranked choice voting that they can actually rank the other candidates as well. And just want to say really quickly, we started out talking about debates. I think Max Lynn's performance highlights the need for reform in debates, even at the U.S. Senate level. I mean, some of the theatrics and, refusal to follow the guidelines of debates was not helpful and took attention away from what Maine voters need and would hope for, a substantive debate between the two front runners. So just another reason why we need to reconsider how and why we hold debates.
Greg Kesich, Susan Young mentioned that this is one of the races that will be decided by ranked choice voting. That was not a given even a month ago.
Oh, no, it always has been. The confusing thing was whether or not the presidential race.
Oh, okay.
By ranked voting.
Okay.
So this is always going to be a ranked choice election. What's interesting is I'm hearing a lot of social media posts from activists who are concerned about how ranked choice voting could affect the outcome, and there's concern that if you rank your candidate, if you don't pick a second choice and you choose one of the independents, you won't get a say in how the election plays out. But there's a concern that if somebody is the winner on election night, but not with 50% of the vote, and then they go, they rank choice vote and go over the line, that could lead to another one of these disputed results. So the sense I'm getting is that people are still not comfortable in some ways with ranked choice voting in an election this high stakes.
All right. Greg, your voice seems to be fading, so I'm going to ask if you can hang up and call back. And in the meantime, we're going to go to Stephen Porter, who is the Maine editor for Seacoast Online and editor of the York County Coast Star. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us again. And York County, boy, center of news, especially the Sanford area. How has the pandemic unfolded in York County in the last month? Summarize it for us.
Yeah, well, thank you, Jennifer, for having me. I think it was about this time a month ago that we were just learning of an outbreak at York County Jail. That, of course, has grown to include 48 inmates, I believe about 19 staffers, some of their family members as well. That's been linked back to the now infamous August 7th wedding in Millinocket, as well as other outbreaks in Sanford. I believe we had 16 active outbreak investigations in York County last week. That includes not only the jail, but Portsmouth Naval Shipyard in Kittery, a lobster eatery in Ogunquit, workplaces, pretty much every type of establishment that you can think of in York County has been touched at this point by the pandemic.
Tell us, bring us an update on what's happening at Sanford High School.
Yeah, so the state's first outbreak investigation at a public school, as you know, is at Sanford High School and Regional Technical School, Regional Technical Center, that is. The school and state arranged for mass testing last week. I think there were about 900 people tested on Friday and Saturday. There are up to 18 total cases at the high school at this point. So one of the big questions that we're asking this week is how these results really inform the school's next steps. Are they going to go back to a hybrid model? Are they going to stick with fully remote at this point? So that's something that we're looking into this week. Obviously, when you test 900 people and only find a handful of cases, that's not the worst case scenario, but we're not sure exactly where it places us at this point.
Tell us more about what's going on with Pastor Bell, the household name now, pastor of Calvary Baptist Church in Sanford.
Yeah, absolutely. So Pastor Bell, as you know, officiated that wedding August 7th that has now been linked to 177 cases at the last count that I heard from Dr. Shaw, and 8 deaths. He has continued to hold services in Sanford and continued to make some unhelpful comments on the efficacy of masks and whether people should be putting any trust in the government at all, or at least going along with efforts to keep communities safe. An update that we just reported within the past week, we and other outlets have reported that that pastor's son is scheduled to get married at a church in Portsmouth, New Hampshire in a couple of weeks. So we are keeping an eye on that. We know that the church trustees are at least a little bit nervous to try and make sure that that wedding does not become another event like the one on August 7th.
And I read, Stephen, talking about the outbreak at the York County Jail, that the guards were not wearing masks. The inmates weren't being asked to wear masks. Are they now?
So that's a good question. We have been reassured by county officials that the York County Jail is now abiding by all of the CDC guidance on keeping inmates safe, inmates and workers alike. The sheriff, Bill King, was on the record earlier admitting that some of those precautions were not strictly enforced. Some were optional when they should have been mandatory. After he went on the record with that, he has been far less inclined to return my calls. So I was able to track him down at a county commissioner's meeting recently, but he still did not want to answer too many questions. So I've been speaking primarily with the county manager, who has offered that reassurance. I also spoke with Department of Corrections Commissioner Randall Liberty, and he was explaining that from the state's perspective, the jail has made sufficient progress that they're not really at imminent threat of having any sort of enforcement action taken against them. So that's really two different officials who are offering some reassurance that they are now doing what they need to be doing to keep inmates and staff safe.
Wow, Stephen, before I let you go, I have to ask you, you're trying to keep track of all these things with a staff of how big?
It's a small team. We do, as I've mentioned in the past, straddle the state line. So I do have some colleagues who primarily focus on New Hampshire, but do come across to help us out in York County. And we have freelancers as well. So it's kind of hard to put a hard number on it, but it is 2020 in the news industry. So it's a very small team.
It's a small team working a lot of hours, I'm guessing, in the month of September.
Indeed.
Yeah. Stephen Porter, thank you so much for calling in, the main editor for Seacoast Online and the York County Coast Star. We'll go to Stephen, who's calling in from Thomaston. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead. Thanks for joining us today. Oh, shoot. We lost Stephen. So we'll move on to our next topic, which is marijuana retail licenses. Susan, actually, I'm going to start with you on this one, Greg, because more are in Southern Maine. Tell us, bring us up to speed on that. I understand October 9th, we may see 5 retail establishments open in Maine.
Yes. Well, 4 years after the referendum in which voters in Maine approved legal marijuana sales, we're going to see legal marijuana sales. And the process has been slow, and it was certainly held back by COVID. But it comes at a time when the state desperately needs revenue. And these shops, these licenses are going to generate revenue for the state. So I think it might actually happen. But it's going to be delayed even further in the city of Portland because there's a scoring matrix that gives extra points to to local business owners. And then there's a referendum on the ballot this year that would limit the cap, eliminate the cap on licenses. But things seem like they're just about to change in a week.
All right. And Susan Young, a big story in northern Maine, especially Aroostook County, all over Maine, but especially Aroostook County, the drought. We're coming to you today when there's some rain, but this has not been the norm this month.
No, it's been a very, very dry summer across the state. Fortunately, I'm from the west, so drought in Maine is different than drought in the Rocky Mountain West and the West Coast. So fortunately, we're not seeing the level of problems that they're having in California, Oregon, and Washington, but certainly cautionary tale about the consequences of climate change and warming planet and changing weather patterns. Time will tell if this is, I hate the phrase, but our new normal as we deal with drier and hotter summers, more unpredictability and more drastic storms, but certainly causing some hardship for farmers in Aroostook County and for others. But it's something that sadly, I think we're going to have to get used to.
Ben, we have out of the state capitol some mixed news this month about the finances of the state. On the one hand, not as bad as was projected, but also some really cautionary, I would say, words from the Maine state economist Amanda Rector about what to expect for the next year or two.
Yeah, things came in quite a bit higher than they first thought. A lot of that was, despite all the job loss and the problems in the restaurant and hospitality sector, Maine did okay, did a little better than we thought. A lot of it was because, the federal government came up with all this extra money for the unemployed and the stimulus checks that everybody got. It kept people spending. They weren't spending at, hotels and restaurants and bars, but they were using that money and spending it elsewhere. So things look a little better. The issue is now with that aid closed and Congress, struggling to come up with this next round of relief, what's going to happen in the economy? And the state ran these, kind of model tests on the state finances, and it looks like if it's a moderate recession, which we're kind of in right now, and there's some more government help, then Maine can weather it a couple bad years using the budget stabilization fund. But if things get worse, and economists everywhere are saying if there's no more congressional relief, then things are going to get worse as spending goes down, and then those kind of things just cycle downward into job loss and business closures, and we go into some sort of sustained recession. Maine's going to be in a really tough place, and we won't be able to handle it with the stabilization fund. We'll have to, some combination of raising taxes and cutting services in a pretty deep way, both at the state level and the local level.
We're talking about the month in news in September in Maine. What are you thinking about? What news matters to you? What do you think the headlines are missing this month as everybody covers COVID-19 and the politics of the season? Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Center Street Arts Gallery. Artist-owned and operated, now open 7 days a week in historic downtown Bath. Center Street Arts Gallery, LLC. The Damariscotta River Grill, open for dine-in and takeout, also serving an expanded prepared foods menu to go. DamariscottaRiverGrill.com. And Bangor Savings Bank, celebrating all the ways people all over Maine are making life a little better. Bangor.com/spreadkindness.
On September 30th, 1918, the Androscoggin County Fair in Livermore is postponed because of the influenza. Public schools, churches, theaters, dance halls, pool rooms, and lodge rooms are closed there as well. This announcement follows on the heels of closures of public establishments 2 days earlier across the state, as hundreds of known influenza cases cropped up in Portland, Brunswick, and Bath. The mayor of Portland, Charles Bailey Clark, called a group of citizens into his office and held a vote on whether to close schools, theaters, dance halls, cinemas, and other public gathering places, which they did the following day. Bangor City Council also voted that weekend to close those facilities, as did Waterville and Augusta.
On this day in Maine's history was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Scher and Maine Masons, celebrating their bicentennial in Maine. Happy birthday, Maine.
August 2020 was the warmest August on record in 6 western states. As our planet gets hotter, its weather is getting more volatile, and the people who will suffer the worst consequences are the most vulnerable among us. Hello, I'm Philip Yun. On this week's episode of World Affairs, we start an ongoing series about our climate future, how much change we should expect, and what we can do about it.
And that's coming up this afternoon at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today we're talking about the leading news stories from the past month. My guests are usual suspects, and we welcome them. Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal, Greg Kessich with the Portland Press Herald, and Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News. We'd love to have you join our conversation in this final stretch of the program. 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us now is Julie Harris. She is the content editor for the weeklies that are associated with the Bangor Daily News, 4 in Aroostook County, plus the Penobscot Times in Old Town and the Piscataquis Observer in Dover Foxcroft, also on the BDN senior editorial team. Thanks for calling in, Julie.
Good afternoon.
We've spoken a lot about the Senate race and the presidential election, but among the readers of the papers that I've just listed, those aren't necessarily the biggest issues right now, are they?
They really aren't. Really, the biggest issues in my areas are the drought and keeping kids and teachers and parents safe during the pandemic as students return to school. We're pretty rural. Those papers cover pretty rural areas.
Share a little bit about the impact of the drought. We touched on it before. How severe is this?
It's getting worse. Well, it was getting worse before today's rain, and I guess there's more predicted. So we'll have to see what that does to us or for us. But the drought is really affecting farmers very much so. We're not so sure on how the drought ultimately will affect the recreational users of rural areas, but the farmers are going to suffer this year. The USDA is saying that crop yields, are going to be down 40% especially in hay and grain and potatoes. And the lack of hay is a real problem this year, and it's probably going to force farmers to thin their livestock herds. Normally, when farmers in Maine are lacking hay, they can go to other states in the country and get hay from them. But everybody is affected by the drought this year, so they'll either have to thin herds or find some alternative to feed their animals, and that's added expense.
What are you hearing from these rural communities about getting kids back to school this year?
Well, that has been it's varied, but with the combination of remote learning and in school, our rural schools are having to front some expenses they weren't planning on, like they need more desks and sorry. Trash man.
my puppy likes to bark when I'm on the air as well, so it's perfect timing. Go ahead.
They were sleeping until then. So the schools are having to purchase more desks so that they can keep students socially distanced. The larger problem is the remote learning aspect, because a lot of the kids live in areas that are not internet friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And so the schools have added expense of getting boosters and trying to get deals with cell phone companies and what have you to provide that access. I have seen some real moments of brilliance during this process. I know of at least one school, the school in Caribou, is offering classes to parents to teach them how to deal with their remote learning kids at home and what exactly the parent's role should be.
Mm-hmm. That sounds wonderful. Anything else you'd like to share with our audience?
I think that... you know, I've seen a lot of community generosity through the drought and through the return to school, and it's just so Maine. It doesn't matter what part of Maine it's in. So I've really found that encouraging in a pandemic and a drought.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for calling in. That's Julie Harris. She's the content editor for the Bangor Daily News Weeklies in Aroostook County, the Penobscot Times, the Piscataquis Observer, and is on the senior editorial team there. I really appreciate you calling and sharing this rural perspective. And one thing that strikes me, Greg, is how different what Julie is talking about than the experience of those in the bigger cities and towns in Maine, where the issues really are working from home and how long will this last and can I find daycare for my kid when my kids are in hybrid classrooms?
Yes, I mean, I think access to high-speed internet is a big divide in the state. It completely changes, you know, how you can adapt in a circumstance like this. I mean, if the kids in your community don't have internet at home, it's going to be, you can't really do distance learning, and they really lose out. But you know, and then there is a big divide in terms of the kinds of jobs that you can do from home and the kinds you can't. I think it's something about a third of the workforce at some point worked from home. That's probably, you know, the max. So 2/3 of the people are out there. They need to be safe. They need to, you know, they may well be exposed to the virus, and 1/3 is kind of, you know, looking up sourdough bread recipes.
That's right.
That's a big divide.
We'll go to Maura, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Maura. Go ahead.
Hi. So I'm a teacher. Today's a remote Wednesday, but I had a student come in early last week, like Monday, with a sore throat and a cold. and the student was put in an isolation room and then sent home for a period of time, still out. And then my own daughter came down with some flu symptoms, which aren't, you know, you don't automatically think COVID, but I took her and took her to the doctor, had her tested for COVID on Saturday, and didn't get the results until Monday, so I could take that day off. But I think that the big problem with parents, some parents don't have the resources to take a day off from work. They can't make it through the week or the month without working. And I think it's almost as though we need some of that relief money to go to the town offices, you know, general assistance, so that they can get in, get something to make up for those losses just to keep their family afloat.
Yeah, Maura, thank you so much for calling, and I hope that both the student and your daughter are doing well. Let me turn to you, Susan Young, with that, because this is what the governors are asking for and also members of the congressional delegation.
Yeah, they're asking for help for state and municipal, tribal, county government. But I like Maura's point of how do you get that money directly to families that need it most. We might have another round of stimulus checks that will help, but it doesn't really address the issue that she's raising. You know, if parents are working, how are they also supposed to take care of especially young children that are trying to learn remotely but need some oversight? And if anyone in the family gets sick, it upends the plans for the week, for the month. Just a very difficult situation that I don't think we fully understand unless we're living in that situation ourselves. I think we need to do a better job of understanding how precarious it is for some families just to get through the day and the week as people are working in different environments and trying to juggle so many different things.
You know, you use the word
a lot more to help them out.
Yeah, you use the word precarious. And it's occurring to me, Ben, that we have this program every month to talk about the news headlines of the month. But really, the reality of the news right now during this pandemic are the small but very serious issues that families and workers and employers are facing every day. The decisions sort of that may not make a headline, but are the uncharted reality of our times.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, there was so much discussion about going, you know, getting the schools reopened, that now that they are in some way, it's easy to forget how difficult that is and how those schools are just figuring out how to do it. And we don't know how they'll deal with some of these issues. And that if you don't have a child, particularly a young child, you might forget that how challenging this is on an hour by hour basis for parents who have to juggle work and homeschooling to some extent and babysitting and all that sort of thing. And then the students themselves who are going through this real-time experiment on how to educate kids during a pandemic. And we just don't know what that's going to do. And we need to make sure that we have that we're open to what's happening to these kids and what they're going through and how it's affecting their education and their development, and make sure that we have the resources to help them. I mean, this is a whole different generation. This is a generation we're going to talk about for decades now. And we just need to make sure that they, you know, have the support that they need to get through this, and that we don't, you know, just kind of check it off like, oh, we've got schools open. Let's move on to whatever's next.
We'll go to Tracy, who's calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Tracy. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Yeah, I just wanted to bring up the subject of, you know, we are rolling out retail stores for cannabis, and yet it is still listed, cannabis or marijuana, the older term, as a class, Schedule 1 drug by the federal government, in the same category as heroin and others. And I have a daughter that benefits from medical marijuana. I'm just wondering, you know, one of the conversations I think we need to have as people in Maine and acknowledging that this drug is not the, you know, the boogeyman drug of yesteryear, how do we encourage the change in classification?
Greg, I'll toss it to you.
You know, it has to happen at the federal level. And if you've been watching Congress, you can see that not much has been happening for quite a while. There's a lot of momentum behind declassifying or changing the classification, which would allow, among other things, the ability for to actually test marijuana and do research on its effects. Right now, it's in such a high classification that it's very difficult to do any kind of research, and a lot of what we, you know, the facts and figures that are bandied around about the you know, the strengths and benefits and weaknesses are kind of anecdotal. So it really would take some action on the federal level. A number of states, I think, in fact, now a majority of states have some form of legal marijuana, either decriminalized or legalized for medical use or for adult recreation. And I think over time, it's just going to become, you can't have this disconnect where the federal government says it's a felony, and the state government says it's a great entrepreneurship opportunity.
Yeah. Well, Tracy, thank you so much for the call. We just have a couple minutes left. Ben, I'm going to toss it to you. What else is on your mind? When you think about the month of September and look forward to coverage in October, what's front of mind for you?
I think the big story besides the presidential stuff is going to be what happens in our schools. I think it's going to, you know, we're seeing some cases of COVID in, I think, schools in at least four counties. How do we respond to that? Are we able to keep those cases within the school and not allow them out into the greater community where they can cause more havoc? How are the kids themselves going to react to it? I think that's going to be the biggest story of the next month.
Susan.
And I would just add, you know, the colleges in Maine remarkably have done a good job, it appears, at controlling coronavirus. We haven't had the issues that some other states have had with colleges and universities shutting down and sending students home. But to Ben's point, you know, with the predictions of the coronavirus getting worse, as the temperature drops and people are inside, there's a real worry, can we keep doing the good job that we're doing? So that's a concern as well, the K-12, and keep an eye on the colleges and universities too.
All right, Greg, you got a few seconds.
I want to pick up on what Susan said last, is that there could be a resurgence as people move back inside. We saw it in the South when the weather got hot and people went into air conditioning. There was a lot of spread of COVID, and that could very well be what we're facing this later this fall.
As always, so great to have all three of you on the program. That was Greg Kesich, the editorial page editor of the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Also with us, Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News, and Ben Bragdon, the editorial page editor of the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Lucy Suchek ran the board today, and this program will be rebroadcast at 7 this evening. Maine Calling, as you know, produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Don't forget, Maine Calling moves to a new time on Monday, beginning next week, live from 11 a.m. till noon, Monday through Friday. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.